This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After 12 years of innuendo allegation and endless investigation, DNA evidence cleared John and Patsy Ramsey of the murder of their daughter, JonBenet. For Patsy Ramsey, that news comes too late. She died in 2006, and John Ramsey worries that some people will always think he's guilty. Raymond Donovan, the former Reagan cabinet officer accused and then cleared of mob charges, put it best. Where, he asked, where do I go to get my reputation back? Now, those are celebrated cases, but a lot of people with considerably fewer resources find themselves in similar circumstances. If you were accused and then acquitted or exonerated, what did you do to get your name back? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can share your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, the Pentagon, the public affairs officer, and media coverage of burials of the dead from Iraq. But first, let me introduce Christina Diaz, who ran a small daycare business when she was accused of killing a baby in her care. After two trials, she was acquitted of any wrongdoing, but she's still fighting to clear her name and her record. She joins us today by phone from San Diego, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I think everybody would understand, if you're on trial, there's understandable suspicion. What really seems to make your case most interesting is what happened after you were acquitted.
Correct.
And what did you do to try to get your name back?
I tried a civil suit, but unfortunately the law is against me, the state law, because everyone is immune.
Everybody in your case who made the allegations against you?
Correct.
And as I understand it, you're now going to court seeking further remedy there.
Correct.
And what's that?
To try to get the arrest off my record, because it's very difficult after that to be able to work.
Mm-hmm. So you want that record expunged?
Correct.
And so for that, as I understand it, the court would have to not guilty is not far enough. They'd have to say positively, you're innocent.
Right.
And that's pretty unusual.
Exactly. Unfortunately, the state law does not support me at all with this.
Now, take us back just a little bit. Obviously, daycare provider, this is a nightmare scenario, accused of killing one of your charges.
Correct.
And what happened? Why were there two trials?
The first trial was a hung jury, so I had to go back to court for a second trial.
And were there those who supported you throughout?
Yes, all my daycare families. I actually even had jurors from my first trial support me for my second trial, and I know that's unheard of, but mm-hmm. I had jurors from my first trial sitting in on my second trial.
And when that second trial came back with a verdict of not guilty, I mean, obviously you're tremendously relieved, but did you think at that moment, well, thank heaven that's over?
I did. I didn't know that I would still be fighting to prove that I am innocent. I didn't know that the law was not supportive of expunging everything, having the... It on my record that I was in jail is still very difficult.
Was there a moment you realized it wasn't over?
Yes, the moment that I went to try to get a job.
And they said, wait a minute, you've got jail time on your record?
Correct. That's on every, any paperwork that you try to get a job, it's now on, have you ever been in jail?
And you have to answer, obviously, honestly, because they can check.
Correct.
And you go into court, as I understand it, on Thursday?
I am not going into court on Thursday.
When are you going to take this case to court to try to get the record expunged?
I've already went.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The first time.
And did it work?
It did not work.
Well, what are you going to do now?
I will continue to try to fight it. But unfortunately, the state law is not on my side.
Well, Christina Diaz, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Christina Diaz is a host family coordinator for an international school of language with us today by phone from San Diego in California. We thank her for sharing her story. Barry Pollack is with us here in Studio 3A. He was the lawyer for Michael Kreutz, the only defendant acquitted in the infamous Enron case, as he also represents Guantanamo detainee Murat Kurnaz and Marty Tanklev, among others. And nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be here.
And, in the case of people who were acquitted, found not guilty, where do they go to get their reputations back?
Well, unfortunately, I think the short answer is there is nowhere to go. Our criminal justice system has it right. The government has to prove you're guilty. You don't have to prove you're innocent.
And they have to prove it by beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Right, and there's good reason for that. It's almost impossible to prove the negative. And so Ms. Diaz's situation is very common. A jury obviously found that she wasn't guilty, but yet the state law on the civil side isn't set up to deal with that and isn't set up to help her with the collateral consequences she now faces from the fact that she was charged in the first place.
But so even according to the government, she has done absolutely nothing wrong. She continues to be penalized for the allegation.
Well, that's right. She's done nothing wrong in the eyes of the criminal law, but she's served jail time and has very publicly been accused of something. We have a public trial system. If there is an accusation, the world becomes aware of it, mm-hmm. and that can have devastating lifetime consequences for somebody in her situation. And in some ways, she's in better shape than a lot of people. She mentioned that she has a case where DNA ultimately exonerated her. Most cases aren't DNA cases. DNA cases are
the Ramsey case, I think, that we were talking about.
In the Ramsey case, absolutely. That's the tip of the iceberg. Those are rare cases. And you heard Mr. Ramsey say even his case where there's been DNA that he is sure that there are people that will go to their grave believing nonetheless he's guilty. Most people don't have DNA. And they can't ever prove that they're innocent.
And they don't have access to that those kinds of resources, or the money to pay the investigators, to pay the lawyers. This can all really add up to a lot of money.
It can add up to a lot of money, but even people who have resources have problems. Marty Tankleff, the individual you referred to that I represented, is from a very wealthy Long Island background, was convicted of murdering both of his parents when he was 17 years old. He served 17 years in prison. Ultimately, we were able to put on a substantial amount of evidence that others committed the crime. He has now been released, and the government is looking to dismiss the charges. But even with all of the resources on a pro bono basis that he was able to bring to bear, he's going to face the same situation that that Ms. Diaz without the resources.
And some people will always believe he's guilty.
Absolutely.
Let's see if we get some callers in on this conversation. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's start with Will. Will calling us from Oklahoma.
Hi. 1991, I was a soldier serving in Germany. And I was assigned to a hospital unit, and I had occasion to give a verbal reprimand to one of my female subordinates. And about a week later, she accused me of sexually assaulting her. I was arrested in front of the soldiers of my unit. I was in front of patients. The MP who arrested me said in a very loud voice, you know, you're under arrest for sexual assault. I was taken out of there. Obviously, the unit wasn't going to have somebody who was accused of this. You know, I was taken down and processed and spent 2 days in the stockade till I was released back to the unit. I couldn't work in the hospital itself. I had to work in the mail room for 4 months. And it all came to a head when the soldier who made the accusation recanted to the unit chaplain, and the chaplain got together with the military prosecutor, and the charges were dropped, but of course nowhere near as ceremoniously as they were announced.
No, it never quite happens that way. So was there a continuing cloud over your head?
Well, I tell you, I could not get in front of a promotion board because your superiors have to recommend you for the promotion board. So I couldn't get eligible for promotion. I had doctors who flat out ordered my superiors not to allow me near their patients. I had those few friends who stuck by me were themselves ostracized. My marriage almost collapsed, and I'm in the reserve now, and I'm getting close on retirement, but I'm two or three pay grades below where
you might have been, yeah.
Where I would have been.
And did anything happen to the soldier who made the false allegation?
I think she got 10 days restriction and 10 days extra duty.
Doesn't seem, well. And there's no recourse, I guess, for you, Will?
There's really nothing that you can do at this point. It's like your speaker said, there's those guys who are operating on the side of the law, you know, the law enforcement, the prosecutors, as long as they're acting in what they believe to be good faith or what they can show that they believe to be in good faith, they're pretty much immune from the results of their mistakes.
And is that, Barry Pollack, as true in the civilian system as it is in the military?
Absolutely. The caller before spoke about immunity, and this caller is absolutely right. In almost every state and in the federal system, you have to prove that law enforcement acted intentionally, knowing that, in fact, you're innocent when they proceeded, as opposed to simply that they made a mistake. And that's often difficult or impossible to prove.
Even if those mistakes in this case, it may not have been a mistake. The allegation was the origin of the mistakes. And, of course, in the military and in civilian life, people have to take allegations of rape or other crimes quite seriously.
And no matter, you know, what, not even so much as an apology. Not even so much as, you know, Sergeant, we're terribly sorry that this happened and that we had a part in this. You know, and what this has done to you in your career, it was like, well, you know, here's a slip of paper saying that this whole thing never happened. You know, goodbye, good luck, have a nice life.
Yeah, an apology might be an admission of mistake, and mistake could be, litigated, couldn't it?
Well, you know, obviously not in the military, but, you know, at the same time, like I said, I couldn't get onto a promotion board. I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
My career was destroyed.
Will, thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry it happened to you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Stay with us, if you would. Our guest is Barry Pollack. We're talking about what happens when you are found not guilty, exonerated, falsely accused. Where do you go to get your reputation back? If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about clearing your name. After 12 years, the Ramsey family was cleared of any involvement in the murder of their daughter, JonBenet, and some accusations are worse than many punishments. Writers can be ruined by a charge of plagiarism. It's not just rape and murder that can change an accused's life. We're talking with lawyer Barry Pollack. He's with us here in Studio 3A. He's defended many individuals and corporations. We want to hear your stories. If you've been accused and acquitted and exonerated, give us your call. Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Barry Pollack, as a defense attorney, is there a moment where you advise a client? I mean, for example, Michael Kreutz, the only guy who got off in the Enron trial, said, look, you're not going to jail, but it's not over.
Well, I have had that conversation with clients before. You know, Mr. Donovan's question about getting the reputation back is a very salient one for all of these folks. You're very publicly charged. In Mr. Kreutz's case, he was one of the first people arrested in the Enron case. It was done very publicly with what they call a perp walk, where they had the cameras catch him in handcuffs. And, you know, the whole world knew about the allegation. It is years down the road, literally, before he is ultimately acquitted of all charges by a jury. And neighbors, family members, anybody who deals with him in the business setting, everyone is aware of these allegations, and they never quite go away. What an individual has to do is rebuild the reputation step by step, and they are under a microscope. People are watching them very closely. I think someone who's been in that situation, or Mr. Tankliff in New York, there are a number of people that are just waiting for him to mess up, waiting to get something that will confirm their belief, well, there was something to it all along. And so all they can really do is rebuild that reputation step by step, hopefully starting with the people that they know best. And if the people who know you, they believe in you, that comes across. I think Ms. Diaz, in her comment about even the jurors from her first trial showing up to show their support in the second trial, that for her probably was the first step of her rehabilitating her reputation.
Well, some of the others apparently believe the other story. And anyway, let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Larry. Larry with us from Sheridan, Oregon.
Yes, thanks for taking the call. Obviously, the press shares so much responsibility in this, the front page accusation, the back page exoneration. And I just wanted to hear if you could address that. And then, of course, the Duke lacrosse case is a classic of whatever happened to the accuser in that trial.
Mm-hmm. And do you speak from experience here, Larry?
Well, my former employer, and I was not working for him at the time, they, in a small town paper here, they were accused of the rendition flights, and it was huge, large font, front page news. I went into the editor's office to ask him what he was going to do if they were exonerated, and he said, well, that won't be as pressworthy.
So. The rendition flights are flying, allegedly flying suspects for the CIA to foreign prisons where they would be
exactly.
tortured. Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Larry's point, Barry Pollack, you've obviously worked some very highly publicized trials.
Yeah, well, the allegations are always highly publicized. The Department of Justice will put out a press release trumpeting the charges. The U.S. attorney will stand there with uniformed agents by his side. That is done in a very public way, and I agree with the caller. The media reports it as if it's fact because the allegation has been made, and it's a lot easier for the media to repeat those allegations than it is to invest 2 years to follow the story and to report the outcome. And the audience may be less interested 2 years later. So I think the responsibility is both with the media and with the audience. I think the audience should be just as hungry for how the case actually comes out when a jury decides it as they are for the salacious allegations that are made at the beginning of the case.
And Larry, how's the company doing?
As far as I know, they're doing very well. And again, this thing, you never heard any follow-up on it as far as, you know, they were exonerated or anything. That the press just doesn't want to play that non-hype stuff. How about the notion of slander? If someone, I have another personal case, but if someone slanders you and you have consequences as a result of it, how often is prosecution for slander or defamation?
Libel and slander very tough in this country, aren't they, Mr. Lawyer Barry Pollack?
Well, they're very difficult. They're almost impossible against the government for the reasons that we've talked about. You have immunity against the government. Going after a private individual, for example, the soldier who made the false allegation, typically that soldier doesn't have resources. There's not going to be a significant judgment there.
A deep pocket you can get into.
A deep pocket you can get into, and it is very expensive to prosecute cases like that civilly. So how many people have the time and the resources to prosecute a civil case when at the end of the day, the likelihood is there's not going to be any payoff for it?
And don't you have to prove not merely that it was wrong, but that they knew it was wrong and said it with malice?
If you are a public figure, and in most of the cases that we're talking about, by dint of the allegation itself, you have become one, yes, you have to prove that as well. Negligence alone is not enough.
Good luck, Larry.
Thanks a bunch.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye. Let's see if we can get, this is Beth. Beth with us from Constantine in Michigan.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Beth.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My husband was accused in 1992 of molesting two of his three children, and we went through 2.5 years, $35,000, and a six-day trial, and he was acquitted of all 21 charges in about 40 minutes when it was all said and done. So we were lucky. He has not been able to really get his record expunged either. I believe in abuse cases like that, it's 10 years past the youngest child turning 18, I think, before they'll even consider erasing it.
So is he on a predator's list?
No, because he was acquitted, fully acquitted. There was nothing to do with that. We went through our U.S. congressman to try and get his record expunged, and he researched it for us and explained about the whole 10 years after the turning 18 thing.
And so even though he's acquitted, that allegation stays on the record until his youngest child is over the age of 18.
Right. Actually, about 28.
28.
Youngest. Yep, 10 years when the youngest accuser turns 18 is 10 years past that. And basically, we were told by our attorney that in terms of his fingerprints, they'll stay out there forever,
mm-hmm.
as far as he knows.
Well, anybody who's ever been arrested, they will stay out there forever. You can't get your fingerprints back or in a lot of places your DNA either, Barry Pollack.
Well, I see.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, and there are consequences, having your DNA in a sexual predator DNA database when you were acquitted of the charges. And some very notorious cases, such as the gentleman in Oregon whose fingerprint was supposedly matched to the train in Spain.
In Madrid, yeah.
So having your fingerprint or your DNA in a database can cause you horrific problems down the road, and it's material that should never have been there in the first place.
Well, Beth, good luck.
Thank you very much. Thanks for my call.
Bye-bye. Let's go next to Tricia. Tricia's calling us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you for taking my call. Last summer, my husband, who was 25, was working in a daycare / preschool and was accused by a 4-year-old girl of being inappropriate sexually with her. And in Michigan, if you're charged with a criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, it's an automatic 25-year-to-life sentence. So my husband, not wanting to risk that with a trial, pled down, and he is now serving a 5-year to 15-year plea agreement.
Because he feared getting the full long sentence.
Yeah, that nobody would listen to him, and we're him being 25, I'm 24, we're pretty young and trusting in the legal system, and we just kind of got taken, it seems like, for most of our money and by a lawyer that didn't do much for us and didn't really give us any hope beyond, more than just pleading out. So.
Plea bargain. And you realize that having admitted to something, people will always believe that he was guilty.
Yeah. And we understand that. And he's going to have to be on the registry, the sexual offender registry for 25 years because he got pled down to a different degree. And so that's, he's going to have trouble finding a job. We're going to have troubles with a lot of things. We can't have children anymore. And, my husband was going into teaching. We wanted a big family. So it's it's really unfortunate, and it's affected our life.
Life-changing event, absolutely. And Barry Pollack, I guess there are situations where people look at the case against them on either poor advice or it looks bad. They agree to a plea bargain to something they didn't do.
That absolutely happens. And, in our country, we have time and time again given new resources to law enforcement and given them more and more draconian penalties. One consequence of that is that the disparity between what you receive if you go to trial and convicted may be tremendous from what you receive by pleading guilty. And it often is a rational decision to plead guilty and accept a year or two, then go to trial and look at 25 years to life. Even if you're 90% confident of acquittal, how many people are going to run a 10% risk of going to jail for life if they can cap their exposure at a year? But then the problem is that's going to have consequences for you that will follow you around, as it obviously has for this caller and her husband.
And Tricia, given the result and given this, you very clearly see what the future holds in terms of the repercussions of this. Do you now wish that your husband had gone to trial and risked it?
No, I wish that we had gotten him a lawyer when he was first convicted, because we were told that it wouldn't have even gotten as far as it did. But we were naive in the system and didn't really understand what it's like when someone is accused of something like this. We didn't understand the seriousness of it. His employers told him not to go with a lawyer because it would make him look guilty. So we didn't, and it got us where we are. So that's what I would go back and change.
All right, Tricia, good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Let's see if we can get this is going to be Anna. Anna with us on the line from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Anna.
Okay, with me, I was charged of a misdemeanors, and also they were dismissed, though, but I wanted to find out, is there going to have any consequences as far as employment, and how do you clear that from the court system?
Any advice? Obviously, I'm not sure you're expert in the laws of the state of Arizona, Barry Pollack.
Well, each state is different. Many states do have an expungement system for first-time offenses, and you should certainly look into that in your state. Many employment applications only ask about felonies. They don't ask about misdemeanors, so that's something else to consider.
The felony is probably going to be dismissed, too, so that's what I've heard.
Well, that's
possibly.
That certainly is helpful. A lot of applications ask about felonies, but some do ask about any offense. And as we talked about with some of the callers earlier, some will ask even about arrests as opposed to convictions. And so certainly if there's an expungement route available, you want to try to avail yourself of it.
Yeah, but how do you clear that, though, from the court system? And
well, if it's expunged, it's cleared, or at least theoretically.
Yeah, what most expungement statutes say is that the record is sealed, meaning that anybody that inquires about the record will not get it. The only people to whom they will have access to that is the court itself, because they're first-time offenses. And so if you were charged with something down the road, obviously the court would need to know that there was this prior there. Otherwise, you might be able to take advantage of that first-time offender statute repeatedly. So the court needs to have access to the information, but the public should not.
Yes, exactly. Okay, that answers my question.
Good luck, Anna.
Okay, thank you very much.
So long. We're talking with Barry Pollack, a partner in Kelly Dry's litigation group. We're talking about where do you go to get your reputation back, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Suzanne's on the line. Suzanne's calling us from Chicago, Illinois.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Yes. I had a lady that I had moved into her apartment that she invited I and my son in, and then she got mad that I wasn't going to be working full-time and paying the bills while she sat on her behind, so she turned in a false complaint to DCFS, who sent an investigator guy over, and then like the next day she called something else in because she thought that wasn't good enough, and they had the cops come and take my son away. And then a couple days after that we went to court, and when we got to the court building, the state's attorney thought it was just baloney. He knew it was just, you know, silliness, and so we didn't even go into the courtroom. He, you know, bounced it before going into court. And I thought that was the end of it, and they were supposed to send a letter saying that, you know, the DCFS was supposed to send it saying that, you know, what had happened. And then I come to find out that she had arranged for it to be sent to her apartment, because obviously I had moved out. And then when I went to go for checking on jobs, thinking that both the registry thing had been bounced off since it was, you know, considered a bogus thing, you know, a false complaint, and it pops up that there was an investigation. It doesn't say that there was one and that, you know, I was cleared, or that it didn't even go to court, or that, you know, or not have it exist there at all. And when I checked into trying to get something done on it, to get it taken off because it was bogus, then they said that I'd missed the 45 days.
There's all these kinds of well, they seem like traps, and I assume they're there for a reason, Barry Pollack, but boy, they seem like they're just there to trip you up.
Well, they are there to trip you up because the court system is not equipped to deal with these kinds of cases. And the court system is trying assembly line fashion to get rid of cases. They don't like to see cases come back, and they don't have the resources to deal with it. And you have the typical problems you have with any bureaucracy. Just because one person has indicated something should be taken out of a file doesn't mean somebody in another records department
has actually done it.
Exactly. So these are very real problems.
Here's an email from Roger in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. Why the question on job applications, have you ever been arrested, when the question should be, have you ever been convicted? If our justice system assumes innocence until proven guilty, doesn't the question, Ray, arrest, therefore assume guilt?
And I would agree it isn't an inappropriate question. The question should be conviction. The real reason why people ask it is they want to be extra cautious, right? The easiest way to avoid a lawsuit is to disallow anybody that anybody could raise any questions about. If something goes wrong.
And arrest, for the most part, are on the public record.
Arrest is for public record. There is a tremendous assumption that people don't get arrested for no reason. So even if ultimately the charges weren't pursued or you were acquitted, maybe there was something there. At least that's the thought process. And so as an employer, if I hire you with that arrest record and then something goes wrong, I'm going to have to answer, why did I have that person on my payroll? And so the easiest course is to ask the question and to stay away. It's certainly not the fairest course.
Is that the question on the application form at your law firm?
I don't know what the application form at our law firm says, but I have seen application forms that ask for arrests. I have seen applications forms that ask if you've ever been the subject of an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you were investigated, they themselves concluded there wasn't anything to it before they even got to the point of doing an arrest.
Yeah.
That would be something that you would need to disclose.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Barry Pollack, a partner in Kelly Dry's litigation group. That's in Washington, D.C., and he was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Coming up, Gina Gray, former public affairs director at Arlington National Cemetery, who lost her job over media coverage for funerals of the war dead. We'll find out why, and we'll talk with Washington Post reporter Dana Milbank next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Last week, Dana Milbank published an article in the Washington Post about how the government continues to limit media coverage of funerals of the war dead at Arlington National Cemetery. The subject of his story is Gina Gray, now the former public affairs director at Arlington. Gray believes she was fired in retaliation for arguing that media coverage ought to be allowed when families ask for it. Today, the Washington Post reports that military authorities will look into her case. If you have questions about media access to military funerals, if you and your family has been through this experience, tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Gina Gray will join us in a couple of minutes, but we begin with Dana Milbank, national political reporter for The Washington Post, with us from the Washington Post studios here in Washington, D.C. Nice to have you back on the program, Dana.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And let's lead with the news. The Secretary of the Army has ordered an internal review of the way Arlington National Cemetery handles media coverage. This follows your article last week. Are you surprised?
I am surprised a bit because they were initially giving quite a bit of pushback on this, but then I think they realized there were more details to it than the higher-ups had realized. Now, an internal review doesn't guarantee necessarily that it will be thorough or exhaustive, but it's a positive sign that they're paying some attention to it.
And your point in your piece was that this was in some ways the ghost of Donald Rumsfeld haunting Arlington National Cemetery.
Yes, and of course, obviously we can't particularly blame Rumsfeld or even his successor, Gates, because this happened at a fairly low level. But it is the sort of thing that went on earlier with the refusal to allow the photographs of the flag-draped coffins returning at Dover Air Force Base, or Secretary Rumsfeld having an automatic machine sign the condolence letters to the families of the fall. And it sort of fits in with that pattern. And it's one that Secretary Gates has tried to exorcise from the Pentagon. This has been a notable exception to that, however.
In those cases, the justification was privacy.
Well, it is, and it is in this case as well. I think it's important to point out at the outset, though, that if a family, the next of kin, say they don't want media coverage, well, there's no media coverage, and certainly there'd be no protest from any of us in this business. We're talking strictly about cases in which the family has said, yes, we would like to have media coverage at this funeral, would like to share this our child, husband's, whatever's sacrifice with the nation. So essentially what appears to be happening is the family saying yes. The folks at Arlington are saying no.
And by saying no, they're putting the line for the media has to stand behind so far away that they can get no meaningful photographs, no meaningful sound.
Yes, you cannot hear the proceedings. The photographers cannot get a line of sight, and in fact, you leave the ceremony before it's over with the very important moment where the folded flag is handed to the grieving widow or mother or what have you. All of these things, I should add, it was very common to be allowed to hear, see, and be very close to the proceedings as recently as 2005 when I went to report on one. I was very surprised that all of that had been taken away.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And James is on the line. James calling us from Austin, Texas.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
I'm a Brigadier General in the United States Air Force, and in my 38 years of military service, I've attended a number of funerals at Arlington, including my son's, who was killed in Iraq 2 years ago. I don't think the media has any place whatsoever at Arlington while there is a funeral in progress, regardless of whether there are those who think that it should be a media event. I think it's a very personal service for the family and for the military.
First of all, General, I'm so sorry for the loss of your son.
Thank you.
And the follow-up question, though, is if the family requests it or if the family says it's okay, shouldn't that be all right?
I can't conceive, and I'm certainly only speaking on my own behalf, I can't conceive of a situation where anyone would want to have a solemn ceremony like that that has a great deal of meaning to the family and to the branch of the military would want to make that public media event. There's absolutely no reason for it.
But
I think it detracts from the ceremony, and it takes away from the reverence of the ceremony.
But if they did, shouldn't that be okay?
Well, my personal feeling is I don't think there should be any exemptions.
General, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Joining us now is Gina Gray, the former public affairs director at Arlington Cemetery in Virginia, the subject of Dana Milbank's Washington Post article called Putting Her Foot Down and Getting the Boot. She's joined us on the phone, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon.
And I don't know if you were just listening to that last caller, a general who said he could not comprehend why he buried his son at Arlington 2 years ago, why any military family would want the media there in attendance. And I assume that's an opinion you've heard quite a bit.
No, not necessarily. I mean, every family is different. You know, and every family is going to grieve in a different way. And I think that's what makes the issue so sensitive and really difficult to get a handle on, is because every family is going to feel differently. Again, when it comes to media coverage, there are some families who absolutely are going to say no, and there are others who are going to allow it, but it's going to be permissive in a way that it's not intrusive. And then there are other families who would prefer to have the reporter sitting right next to them. And I think part of that is because they want to be able to share the story of their loved one.
And how did this come up in the context of your story?
Media access?
Mm-hmm.
It was my second week on the job. And there was a funeral for a U.S. Marine Corps lieutenant colonel. And I had gone out and kind of set up, as I was told, you know, there's a rope line and you have to keep the media back. And so I set it up. I went to pick up the press, Dana Milbank included, and I got back out there, and it had been moved pretty far away.
By whom?
The deputy director of the cemetery.
And on whose instructions? On whose orders?
Him.
Just his own?
Yes.
And was this the reflection of any policy that you were aware of?
That is, and that was my issue, is that there was no policy. There was no written policy. There was no regulation. There was no standard. And that was my problem, ultimately, is that there was nothing in black and white to refer to. There was nothing that you could point definitively to and say, this is the policy, this is the regulation. And so, as a result, things would constantly change. And that was my issue.
That it was arbitrary, in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and bottom line, the cemetery bureaucrats took control away from the families. I think ultimately it is up to the family whether or not media coverage should be allowed, and the family should be the one to determine what media coverage means to them.
Dana Milbank, as Gina Gray just said, you were there that day. Why were you there? And tell us about the experience from your point of view.
Well, I had gone, as I do occasionally, to write a column about a funeral. I had last done it a few years earlier, and it was quite a moving a ceremony. I returned to do what I thought would be the same thing, then realized suddenly that we could neither hear nor see what was going on. So I actually wrote about that experience of not quite seeing or hearing the funeral, and I had not realized that this set off this internal debate that ultimately led into to Gina's firing.
And Gina, are you convinced that your dismissal was retaliatory?
Absolutely, yeah, I am.
What is it more than anything that points that out to you?
I think just from that moment, from the day that the Lieutenant Colonel Hall funeral occurred, and I had put my foot down and started questioning, you know, where are these regulations? And then when I couldn't find them, I began questioning it further. And I think from that point on, it was very hostile and just kind of contentious.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Gretchen, and Gretchen's calling us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi there, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A secondary question that not directly relates to this, but is it possible that the quote-unquote rule of no media coverage also kind of stems back from this Hillsborough Baptist Church who puts up these incredibly hateful anti-gay signs, I mean, protesting, you know, a completely unrelated subject. They're not protesting the war. They're protesting a gay lifestyle. And then just to try and prevent any of them from getting anywhere near the funeral, the procession, or anything else between.
Dana Milbank, there have been these, protests that are very upsetting to military families of people. Well, I think Gretchen's got it right in a capsule.
Sure. I think it's unrelated because those have not been, to the best of my knowledge, at Arlington, which could obviously crack down on that sort of thing anyway. Arlington has a very special place in the country's memory. It is the most hallowed ground for somebody who has served in the military to be buried in. So that's why there is perhaps an additional public access question in terms of what should be viewed of the services there. And as the earlier caller, the general, certainly when somebody had that sort of a point of view, there would never even be a question. But in other cases, when the family was open to it, there is this matter of balancing the family's privacy with the American public's need to know that there's still a war going on.
And Gina Gray, if memory serves, that group lost a First Amendment case and were found prohibited from further demonstrations like that. Were there any concerns about demonstrations like that at Arlington?
Well, they can't protest on cemetery grounds. Nobody can protest on the cemetery grounds. And the burials are far enough away that if they were to protest, you know, outside of the gates, you still couldn't hear them while the ceremony was going on.
Gretchen, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking with Gina Gray, the subject of Dana Milbank's Washington Post article called Putting Her Foot Down and Getting the Boot, and with the author of that piece, Dana Milbank. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Amy on the line. Amy calling us from Washington, D.C.
Hi, this is Amy Nyberger-Miller. My brother was killed by a roadside bomb in Iraq and buried at Arlington National Cemetery actually last year. And my family did decide to permit media coverage at the funeral.
And again, we're so sorry for your loss, but what happened when, what went into the thinking? Did people talk about it?
We actually had an internal family discussion about what we wanted to do with media coverage. I actually work in media relations and have for over a decade. And so I spoke with my parents about what they wanted. And our decision as a family was that we wanted to find a place of middle ground, which was we did not want coverage that was exploitative. We wanted to see coverage that would honor my brother and the sacrifice that he had made, and that would honor his life. And so for us, that meant that the first week after my brother was killed, before we even went to Arlington for the funeral, we did not do any on-camera interviews. We did do an interview with our local newspaper. And we did feel that in the case of Arlington National Cemetery, that the media, we knew they would be back a ways, but that the pictures and video that they would get would also help our whole community grieve.
Mm-hmm.
Because my brother grew up in this community.
And in the event, did it?
I think that it did help our community, because 40,000 people could not go from a small town to watch their local hero be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And yet there were hundreds of people who were deeply moved by my brother's death. And I think it was a way for people to be able to experience that and to also, you know, be part of that experience.
Thank you for the call, Amy. Let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Will. Will with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi, Will.
Thank you for taking my call. Last summer, I buried my father, who was a career Air Force combat pilot, and we buried him in Arlington. And I agree with the general. I don't think the press has any business being in Arlington. The way we solved the problem, as the previous caller mentioned, a lot of people wanted to grieve over my father's passing, but weren't able to attend, mostly because of their age, we actually hired a videographer. And the videographer made CDs for us. And
but it was all private.
It was all private, and since that time, my mother's shown CDs to probably 400 or 500 different people that wanted to participate in it but couldn't make the trip. So I think rather than having the press, I think that's another option people have, but I would be against the press.
And they were they in any sense intrusive? Did anybody try to?
No, they weren't. In fact,
I say they, I mean we, I guess.
Right. The videographer explained that he would be from afar. He had a telephoto lens. I think the closest he got to when we were they were folding the flag to give to my mother, he was probably 50, 75 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not intrusive at all, and yet it allowed a lot of literally hundreds of people to participate in the ceremony.
Well, again, we sympathize with your loss. Thanks very much for the call, Will.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Gina Gray, as you mentioned, families are really, really different. Those two calls illustrative of that.
Well, I think it just goes to show that you can't set a really put forth a black and white standard. You know, you can't put grief in a box and expect that everybody is going to react the same way. And so I think that's where it's important that we let the families have control.
And Dana Milbank, quickly, since Gina Gray's dismissal and the publication of this article and the follow-up, have things changed at Arlington?
Not immediately, but I mean, they have numerous funerals every day, but the only ones in contention, of course, are the ones who were killed in Iraq or Afghanistan, and these are mercifully few and far between these days, but no doubt we'll be revisiting this in the weeks to come.
Dana Milbank, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Neil.
Dana Milbank wrote Putting Her Foot Down and Getting the Boot for The Washington Post, and he joined us today from the studios of The Washington Post in Washington, D.C. Gina Gray, thank you very much for your time, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Gina Gray, former public affairs director for Arlington National Cemetery, joined us on the phone. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.